the Edge with April Mahoney Brains. Here, this is the place where the conversation is pointed, the guests are sharp, and the responses are never dull. Welcome home, Brains.
Coming to you straight from San Diego, California, let's welcome our host, April Mahoney.
Namaste.
Oh,
you're very sweet of you. I have a cup of coffee here.
Look at that. On the Edge. Well, I got to go get my coffee mug, too. I like to get a little raw footage, like recording now, so people can see how we are in real life. I'm so excited to have you here, Ms. Cook.
Oh, please call me Susan.
You're going to have the best conversation here for sure. So let me go get something to drink, take a deep breath, get ready for an exciting conversation here on the Edge. I'll be right back.
Deep breath, energy, all that stuff. Woo! Cool. I'm all done now.
Okay. Hold on a minute. Wonderful, wonderful, wonderful. Brains, look at who I found down in Australia. Okay, it's Susan Cook.
Hello.
We're going to have a conversation here that is just going to be real relaxed, real focused, because this woman, I'm telling you, I'm looking at my notes and I had to take notes because she's just doing that much great stuff in the world. Susan, please introduce yourself to my brains and tell them a little bit about your story and who you are before we get into the meat and potatoes.
Oh, I like meat and potatoes. Hi, everyone. My name is Susan Cook, and I'm here with the privilege of actually speaking to April. She's an amazing woman. I love her to bits already. I've only really just met her in the last couple of, when was it, April? About 2 or 3 weeks ago, 4 weeks, yeah?
And I was so disappointed. She was right here in California, and I wasn't able to meet with her because she was doing some stuff, but that's all right. We're going to meet because I love to travel, and you're going to come back this way too, so we're going to see each other for sure.
You have no chance. You're on my agenda. Yeah. Basically, I'm actually, I'm a baby boomer, 50-plus lady. I believe in the power of women at that stage in their lives. So I actually coach and promote people who are going through that final stage of transition after they've completed their work and all the other things, when they're truly finding themselves. Wow. I'm a life mastery consultant and dream builder coach, and I have other coaching qualifications. April, I've been in the education business for close to 40 years now.
Wow.
Yeah, I love people. I have a passion for children and young adults. And in the course of my various things that I've done in my life, because I'm eternally curious and I never stop learning, because that keeps your brain going, doesn't it, Brains?
That's this right.
Hello, Brains.
Hello.
I got one of these, yeah.
Yes, we're doing it. We are doing it in full effect. And thank you so much for acknowledging my brains. They get off on that. They like it. It's like a cult-like following. You know, where's that yellow postcard?
Well, it's perfect. In fact, it's given me some wonderful ideas. I'm going to copy you. I just won't call myself Brains. I don't know if I've got as many as you have.
Well, you may not use the Brains because I'm trademarking the brain, but you can use the yellow postcard and the hello all day long.
I'll send you a proof before I launch.
You're funny. But, you know, I don't even know where to begin with you, but what I want to do is I kind of want to weave in and out of your story because it is absolutely incredible. So let's talk a little bit about alternative health. Let's start there. And, you know, Reiki and NLP and being a dream builder coach. What does that all mean?
I would say about 25 years ago, I became really curious about the holistic side of a person, the things that you can learn in this world. So we have our doctors and everything else. I decided that I wanted to actually, first of all, learn about homeopathy. and the Bach flower remedies. So I trained under a very well-known homeopath by the name of Del Smith for 3 years. And in the course of that time, she actually taught me about the Bach flower remedies as well. And I became more and more curious about this because I realized that there's a side of... There's a side in this world that with self-help, you have the ability to actually do so many things without having to go into modern day medicine. I'm not saying that that's not good, because I absolutely believe in that as well. What I'm saying is there's other ways to actually be able to uplift yourself and carry yourself through health. And then it was 20 years ago when NLP really was actually first created. And that is using both sides of your brain and learning how to actually work that to be able to live a better life. So that works you into the world of quantum and metaphysics. In those days, medical science and everything they weren't skeptical. They just watched. These days, of course, they'll actually send their patients along to practitioners. And in this, you actually use various forms of hypnosis, which has now become very popular internationally. And that can actually help you in various ways of finding yourself. April, everybody gets a sort of empty feeling. It's a sort of like it's a yearning. It's like life could be better for me.
Right.
And when I started feeling that, I started thinking to myself, there has to be a way that is better. I'm on this earth for a reason. Mm-hmm. I'm not one of the sort of lemmings, and not every single one of us who is born at this time onto this beautiful, wonderful earth of ours is a wonderful spirit experiencing a human experience on this earth.
Right, right.
So
I've had so many human experiences. Tap into some of your worldly travels. I mean, you have shared with me some of the most compelling stories. Tell us a little bit about your journeys and your travels around the world and some of the people that you've seen and some of the experiences and some of the atrocities.
I've been very fortunate to have many experiences in my life. And in dream building, as a life mastery consultant, we teach people how to turn the anger and fear from experiences into lessons. I'm fortunate to have had many, many lessons in my life. I was born in Africa, in what is now known as Zimbabwe, in a funny little country town. By mistake, my mum was on the way to the city to have me, and I just decided to get born there.
I hope you weren't born under a bush.
I almost was. That's not unusual for Africa. Many people get born under a bush.
I know.
No, I was born in a hospital, a funny little mission hospital. And I, at the age of 11, I experienced loss. My father was an airline captain, and he was transferred from what was known as Southern Rhodesia in those days up to Central Africa, a country called Malawi. It used to be called Nyasaland. So I'm showing my age now. I've been through all the name changes in Africa as well.
changes too, you know. It was a different time back then.
It was a very different time in many, many different ways. I've seen through apartheid in South Africa, which I never experienced growing up in Zimbabwe because we didn't have that. Mm-hmm. But I saw the inauguration of the wonderful Nelson Mandela, who I love and respect he was an amazing man. He mm-hmm. faced his fear after coming out of prison and dealt with it as his lessons. And when I've suffered my first experience of huge loss is my parents were transferred up into Malawi. And at the age of 11, they left me behind. They took my brother and sister with them. And they left me behind. They never thought of explaining to me that they left me behind with a stranger. I didn't know who she was. She owned and ran a boarding hostel. Mm-hmm. The reason why I didn't understand is they thought I was quite clever. Woo! And they wanted to leave me in my school until I'd finished, ready to go to, we call it senior school in England and in Africa. I think you, from the age of 12, you transition into a different level in.
Yeah.
Yeah.
High school, but it's high school. Mm-hmm.
So that was I thought I was abandoned. That was my first experience of being abandoned. Of course I wasn't, but I could only go back in those days. We had no internet. We had no Skype or Zoom or any of these sort of things. So I never heard from my parents for months on end. And then suddenly I'd get an air ticket and I could go back to Malawi twice a year. But in the course of this, it actually started to give me strength and independence. So I became very independent from a very young age. And then I would go back for holidays in Malawi and I experienced the early days of the then Kamuzu Banda, Kamuzu Hastings Banda. It was the very first time that country became independent, one of the very first African countries to become independent. And experienced this man. He actually used to call for my dad to fly him on his little private aeroplane. And so I met him, Hastings Kamuzu Banda. And he was an incredible man with an incredible story. He'd been a little boy born in Nyasaland, Malawi. He'd been brought up by missionaries in a mission school and educated. Highly intelligent, and he decided that he was going to have something better, and he was one of my first sort of people that I respected. He walked all the way from Malawi all the way down to South Africa. Ooh. And was taken in by a very kind old Afrikaans, those are the Dutch speaking South Africans, woman. She took him in. And she housed him and she fed him. And she actually brought him up. She put him into university. And he then ended up as a Harley Street surgeon. He went across to England and trained as a, he worked with children. And he became a Harley Street practitioner, doctor. So he was a genuine doctor.
Wow. So I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt. So he helped all of those people, but did he also help you? And, you know, you said that you saw some atrocities there. Share a little bit about that, what happened.
So that was the start of me actually seeing how incredible you can come from nothing to something massive.
Right.
He went back to Malawi and became the president. Yeah. And in the interim, I'd qualified after school as in fine art, marketing and advertising. And I ended up living in Madagascar and actually working in the various islands in the Indian Ocean. And I went back to Malawi and I met my husband and we went back to Zimbabwe, which was then newly independent, was Robert Mugabe. Mm-hmm. And we had a farm in the Lower Eastern Highlands in a very, very beautiful area of Zimbabwe. And we created this farm. It became a model farm. People from all over the world actually came and started to want to, especially charity organizations, they wanted to actually film and see what we'd actually done with our farm. So at peak season, we employed 1,200 people.
Wow.
It was a mixed farm. It was a coffee estate, tea, burley tobacco. Whoop. don't talk about tobacco, and and cattle.
No, they're growing cannabis now. They're not worried about tobacco. They're growing.
Cannabis. I think cannabis is cool. It makes you. anyway, kind of very long story short. We had this very beautiful farm, and it was a very desirable farm. And when things started to get difficult for Robert Mugabe, who had decided he wanted to be president for life, and the country was a beautiful country. It was known as the Petite Perle de l'Afrique, the little pearl of Africa. And people from all over the world were investing in this amazing country. And then suddenly the people had got tired of Mr. Mugabe being in charge, because you don't just have one president for life. It doesn't work that way.
Really?
And they want
to the one that we got now. He thinks he's stuck in there for life.
I think it's time for him to go and retire personally. But anyway, that's just my opinion. Other people feel that in a different way. Anyway, Robert Mugabe suddenly decided he wanted to take the commercial farms for his own gain and profit.
Oh, wow.
And he, for people who've never had things taken away from them like that, in who've faced war or anything else, because I actually faced what was then the Rhodesian War as well, which, prior to that, which was at the same time as the Vietnam War. Mm. So we used to use all the Vietnamese song, the songs, you know, John Denver and all the others, I can still remember at school growing up with all of these songs. Mm-hmm. And we basically had this, when we went back to this farm, this from Malawi, we developed it into this incredible model farm. We it became one of the top 25 farms on Mugabe's list.
Wow.
And he wanted it. And what he was doing is he was actually dishing out these amazing farms, highly lucrative, even on an international basis, to his cronies who were in government with him and basically wanted to make sure that he would stay in power by giving away and gifting homes and homesteads and farms that would profit him. So we had things happen. He would send in his army, who were trained by the North Koreans' 5th Brigade. So you can imagine how cruel they could be. Yes. And we tried and tried and tried to get our farm off this list. And of course, it didn't happen. And so when people were resisting, and you know, at that time, they were talking about the white commercial farmers. There were Indian farmers. There were indigenous African farmers. They were everybody who were commercial farmers who were targeted, who had really good farms. They all had an equally bad time. And he started to send people in, and it was called Jambanja. So Jambanja is like war. When they're going to go for you. And when they came to Jambanja, you, we had security fences and things around that were in aftermath from the Rhodesian War. Mm-hmm. We had all the security and everything. They would just take them down and then come in and terrorize you.
Wow.
And brutalize many things in many ways. They'd kill your dogs. They'd hamstring your cattle. They did some terrible things. I mean, one evening we were out socially, and by then all the reporters from all around the world had started to come in, because this was a story.
Right, right.
And we were at a barbecue. At that time, I'd actually just completed, I just qualified as a journalist. Mm-hmm. So I was friends with many, many journalists, and I was invited there, and my husband was there with me. And we literally, it was in the early days of mobile phones, cell phones.
Okay.
And one of the,
right?
Yeah, one of those things, like a walkie-talkie.
Right, right.
Mind you, a walkie-talkie is tiny, an old-fashioned walkie-talkie. I'm a baby boomer. I've seen it all.
Absolutely.
Anyway, they the one of our farming friends in our vicinity had actually just recently been interviewed by somebody from the BBC, and he had the number, the cell phone number of this report, of this international reporter. And the phone came in, he put it on speakerphone, and we literally heard this friend of ours, who my husband had actually been to agricultural college with, crying out for help. And they'd gone into the police station for safety, five of them. And this was in the early days before things really started to get bad with the farm invasions. And he was calling out for help. And the story is very long, so obviously we've got limited time here, April. But what happened was literally the army had come in, and we heard our friends being murdered over a mobile phone.
Wow, that is awesome.
And so it wasn't unusual for the people in Zimbabwe to face this sort of thing, because they'd been through a bush war.
Right.
But what it was it was a beautifully peaceful time. Our little pearl of Africa suddenly was off kilter, and it became very confusing. What happened to us personally is that overnight we were very, very wealthy, even in what international standards. We lost our home. Our daughters lost their home. We lost the banks foreclosed on us overnight. Mm-hmm. And we were suddenly homeless. We were like refugees.
Wow.
And that's an experience that you actually learn as well. I'm able to understand what it's like. I had a lot to do with refugees before, because there were many refugees coming in onto our farm from Mozambique. There was a big war going on there between the Frelimo and Renamo. And the atrocities there were horrendous. And our farm was on the border of Mozambique. And the Mozambicans would flood in, and I had soup kitchens and things like that. And we actually had we created a sort of almost like a hostel to house them. And we had social workers who'd been trained to help with medical things, basic medical things and everything. So they were able to sort of look after them and get them clean. They had showers and right. some food, and their little children got to eat.
So after you left all of that and you settled, did you end up settling in Australia? Is that where, you know, were you and your husband?
No, we went down to South Africa because heritage-wise, my family had actually come across from France and Germany and the UK and Ireland in the early days of settling South Africa, which was one of the first colonies in Africa to be settled, because in those days Queen Victoria wanted to create farmland all over the world. And of course there was gold and diamonds and Kimberley and everything else. She wanted all of that stuff too.
It's still there, but you know, it's blood diamonds now. It's a whole different
horrible
to settling in with you and your husband. That was quite an experience too, that you shared with me, that, you know, after experiencing all of this loss, seeing all this tragedy, but also being very privileged and having great wealth and being able to support others, you found that there was some differences in your life, and that your husband was not honoring you as a woman, and that was making you feel a certain kind of way. Share with my brains a little bit about that story.
Yes, April. The reason why I gave the sort of background on what happened prior to my husband's death, he passed away 4 years ago. It will actually be 4 years in October. I'd sort of stuck it out. There were many, many people who had divorces, separations, all sorts of things, because these sort of tragedies do lead to separation. And I'm old-fashioned enough to believe that I had to hang in there. I started off my marriage with my husband. It was my second marriage. He adopted my children. And because I got married really young. I was a rebel. I still am. Woo!
Well, I mean, you gained your independence there, you know, at a very early age. So
I did. So what happened was I stuck in there. I'd been married to him for about 5 years, and things really, on the marital side, they suddenly became very confusing to me. He stopped wanting to have intimate relations. He started to ask for a separate bedroom, and he was a big snorer. So I was actually quite relieved. I thought, okay. But it was hurtful. And in the course of this time, various things happened in my life where I started to lose my identity. So the woman you see sitting here has had 4 years to grow up. Wow. And become the woman I am now. But in the course of the 30-year marriage I had with this man, who was complicated, big, tall, good-looking, looked like a football player, a rugby player, we would say. he was complicated. He'd go through these big mood swings. I started to lose confidence in myself. He would tell me that I was ugly, that I was worthless, and all sorts of things. And mental abuse, I started to believe him. And then once we were in South Africa, and we'd lost the farm and everything, he was an incredible, incredible artist. So we actually created a new home, and that's another story in itself. We had a gallery, and I'm an artist as well. And he told me I wasn't good enough, but I had been selling my work all over the world, but I believed him, and that I should concentrate on marketing him and getting him set up, which I did because I'm qualified in marketing, the old fashioned kind, not the stuff on the digital.
You're his partner. So, I mean, you know, absolutely. Yeah.
So that all happened. And then things started to go in a sort of topsy-turvy way. He would disappear for ages. And he then said he needed to travel around Africa as an agricultural consultant. And I would go away and actually work as an educational consultant in various places all over the world. And when I'd go away, I became me.
Right.
And when I returned back, within 3 weeks, I would become this mouse and this automation. And the one day he actually said to me, look, we've got to get out of South Africa. We must go back to the UK. So he was at the time in Uganda, and I would visit Uganda. In fact, I actually taught kids under a mango tree there on the South Sudanese border. That's another story as well, April. Beautiful children. One set of clothes, no shoes. They'd walk for half a day to be able to learn under a mango tree. How about that?
That is great.
They're so hungry for education, and they're so precious. I love African children. They have this deep laugh and this innocence and just hunger for education. Hunger, big time.
So you anyway, about your yeah, you were telling us about your husband.
Yeah, so I went back to England. He returned to England from Uganda. I then actually had a contract with a royal family in the Middle East as an educationist. Mm. I went away, and we were at the time, the royal family and I were at the time in their Paris home. And I got a call from my daughter, and she said, Mom, Dad's returned. At that time, he'd been working in Mozambique. And she said, Dad's returned from Mozambique. He's in Canterbury Hospital and he is so sick and he is crying out for you. You need to get back here really quickly. So I spoke to my prince that I was working for and he said, of course, Susan, you need to go back. And I went back and I walked into this hospital and there was this emancipated, tiny, skinny man lying in the bed. My heart just broke. And he had been diagnosed with cancer, terminal cancer. So we moved him to a guy's hospital in London, which is an amazing hospital, always in the hope that he'd survive. Of course, he didn't. I literally slept on the floor under his bed 24/7 to be with him and nurse him because he didn't want me to be out of his sight. Mm. And once he died, it was 4 days after he died. And I started to get his affairs together and everything. And I realized I needed to get hold of his people he'd been working with to tell them that he'd passed away. Mm. And he'd always been very, very secretive, extremely secretive with passwords on everything. And because I'm me, I just never thought anything about it. Thought, okay, he's got passwords. And I discovered two phones.
Because I want the passwords. I want your blood type.
I should have been like that. I would have left a long time before then. Anyway, he'd purposely, I think it was his way of letting me know about him. He'd purposely left the passwords off these phones. I charged them up. I thought it would have all his contacts on, and a Pandora's box was absolutely just exploded in front of me. Mm-hmm. And within these phones were numerous emails. Addresses, numerous files, and I opened them up, and I had to sit down. I just sort of looked at this, and I thought, wow. And basically, what it is that he was on every single dating site you could possibly think of, and they were all the majority were gay websites. So 4 days after his passing, I discovered that my husband was a closet gay.
On the down low.
And my heart broke for him because I have wonderful gay friends.
Right.
And they've been in my life all my life. And I sort of said, why couldn't you tell me the truth? I would have had a different life and you would have. However, In the course of this time, I started to really start to look at the files. He'd kept files right back of his liaisons and things right up to 2009. And I then, that was part of it. The other part of it was that I discovered when I went into actually have to find finance and things like that, that he'd been blackmailed as well. And the person who was blackmailing him knew about me and knew he didn't want me to know because he liked having his sort of family and that sort of thing. I was also a pretty good supplier of money as well with my jobs.
The thing was, and from an outsider looking in, you said a couple things that kind of struck a chord with me. Number one, why tear me down to lift yourself up? But that is a part of the secret. Number two, you say you had amazing gay friends. Having a gay friend, having a gay husband, relationships are a lot different now. People have polyamorous relationships. They have open relationships. If one is more sexually prone to another one, as long as you have that conversation and you're cool with it. But he didn't want that. He kept the secrecy. But he was also, you said, that he was a narcissist.
Yes.
And people toss that word around, but he was a true narcissist. Everything was about him. He was a superior one. No one could do anything better than him and all of that. So that tore down your self-esteem.
Yeah.
Your money is gone. You're not considered a well-established artist. Here you are pouring your heart into these world leaders and to their families. You're also pouring your heart, you know, into these children under a mango tree. All of this, what did this do to you inside when you realized what was going on and your light bulb came on? You know, how did you look at yourself in the mirror and say, is this Susan Cook? Who the hell is this I'm looking at?
You know, April, it was... We use an expression, one of my really good friends, his name is Wayne, and he's a wonderful, supportive friend. And every time I sort of do the dance with him, Susan, I'm going to slap you with a big wet fish. So I felt like I'd been slapped with a big wet fish. And I sat there with all of this evidence around me. And I took a deep breath and I thought, I actually felt stupid. I felt hoodwinked. I felt used. And all the sort of support and everything else that I had actually put into this one very one-sided relationship was, it was like, I couldn't even go to him and say, well, talk to me about this.
Right,
because
right.
He was dead. Mm-hmm. And the other part was my beautiful daughters now had to be told the truth of all of this as well. Mm-hmm. And the interesting part of this whole thing is, in the course of all this time, I have always journaled. I've always reflective journaled. I didn't know at the time it was what is modern day now called reflective journaling, mm-hmm. but I had, and it had been a kind of salve and therapy to me when I was down and lonely, and because he'd actually stopped me from even having friends. He did not want me to have friends. He didn't even like me to have a relationship with my brother or my mom, or he separated me from everything. And that's what narcissists do. They keep you away from the ability of communication with people. They also ridicule you in front of people. They make you feel silly and as if you've got no brains. And I know that I've got those. Anyway, because of the reflective journaling, I went back and I always keep my diaries. I went back and I started going through them. And the light bulb moments that came from these journals, and there was nothing really bad in these journals. They were sort of like, I don't understand why this is happening to me. And one stage, when we were actually in South Africa, I would, my husband would pour me a glass of wine, which I thought was suddenly became a very generous thing. He'd pour me a glass of wine in the evening and I'd drink it, one glass of wine. And the next day I'd wake up in my bed and think, how did I get here?
Wow.
So when I was going back through all of these journals, and I actually was able to associate with his files and his very, that narcissists are chess players. They have to strategically know exactly what's going on mm-hmm. in their lives so they don't make a mistake with their lies. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I realized that he'd actually been putting the date rape drug into my one glass of wine. And the reason was so that I'd go asleep. He'd put me to bed. He's a big man and I'm tiny, so he could just put me to bed. Mm-hmm. And he could then have his paramours, I'll call them, mm-hmm. into our home, into his room, and I would be totally unaware of what was going on. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, so I started to...
It was yeah. me, I'd dig him up and kill him again.
He got cremated. I couldn't do that. Mm-hmm. He got washed out to sea.
And you know, all of this, and again, I say this to my brains that are on the down low, because I know that I've got some followers, women that are being subjected to this, pay attention and live yeah. your truth.
Absolutely. Your truth.
You know, you have a right to feel the way that you feel sexually, financially, spiritually. Live your truth. tell the person that you know. You never know. They might be down with it. They might be voyeurs and want to watch.
Thank you for sharing that with me.
Well, okay, but if somebody loves you, love them enough to set them free. I totally agree. Don't hold me hostage. Don't do this to my children. You know, they grew up with a warped sense of what love and responsibility and commitment is because of lies and deceits. You don't have to do that. Now, I know, you know, I'm sitting here talking all this stuff, and it's easier for me to say because I'm not living it. But try it. You know, you never know if a person really loves you. They'll be understanding. They'll be compassionate. And if they're not, then this is an opportunity for you to break free. But if you're really living a life in secret, you're living a lie, and you're never going to be fulfilled. You're always going to be haunted by it. You're always going to have to watch your back. You never know when somebody's going to blackmail you or try to steal something from you. Another thing I want to ask you too is your health. Okay. Now, I think that would be one of my biggest challenges, because you're taking me to bed with you and your buddies. You know, all kinds of stuff are happening. You're having sex in all kinds of different ways. Maybe it's protected, maybe it's not protected. But now you are putting my life at risk. And I remember you telling me that shortly after that, you found yourself, you know, in a clinic trying to be tested to see if, you know, if it really was cancer, if it was something else.
Absolutely. You know, April, this is where there are times when I'll, and it keeps me going. There's times when I know that in his very strange way, he loved me very much. Mm-hmm. So easily 20 years before he died, he actually came and told me he was impotent. I'd come back from working in the UK for 3 months. I got to the airport, and narcissists are very clever actors. And what they also do is they take the sex away from your marriage. It's a pattern, and they make you feel insignificant. And I said, "Oh well, what's going on?" And he said to me, "I went to the doctor, and I told the doctor that I've got a very unattractive, ugly wife, and I can't do anything." And I was devastated, because I'd come back from 3 months and everything else, and I had this thrown in my face. And I, who I am as a compassionate person, I felt extremely sorry for him. And I said, "Well, let's sit down and talk about this." And I basically said to him, "Can you explain what's going on?" No, this is what's going on, and that's you definitely have to be in a different room to me. I can't touch you, I can't look at you, etc., etc., etc. And I was very hurt, and I felt very ugly. But this is actually a process of a true narcissist.
Wow.
So it's what they do. It's what they do to their captive.
He was grooming you in another.
He was grooming. They groom. They genuinely groom. So when people use the term of narcissist these days, I sort of get like this, because when you're dealing with a true narcissist, they are a sociopath, psychopath. Mm-hmm. They just haven't killed anyone yet.
Mm-hmm. Well, he killed your spirit.
They do kill your spirit.
He killed your sickness. So he murdered you in a way.
Slowly, very slowly. So what happened was, in the same week of his passing, I still had to go to an STD clinic to get tested. So not only had my husband died of 30 years, not only had I discovered all of these things, I had to go to a clinic and sit in the clinic and in amongst other people. And some of them are, you know, they're all there. You could see they're hurting, and I was hurting too. And I had to go and get tested and checked to see that I was safe. which of course I was.
Thank God.
Thank God. The lead up to that actually also I learned a lesson. I started to understand what it's like to not know if you have AIDS or a sexually transmitted disease, because I had to experience it and I had to sit in amongst people who were sitting there. And many men and many women that I sat with, because I'm gregarious, so I chat to people and they talk to me. Being an intuitive empath, people automatically want to be able to tell me their story. And many of them would tell me how their wife or husband or partner had been unfaithful, and then they've just discovered that this has happened, and they were being tested for various STDs.
And so in Africa, I mean, you know, AIDS was running rampant there. I mean,
it does. Yeah.
Crazy. It was good. There was no medication and people were just, you know, just dying in the streets. And, you know, I was working with a group, shout out to Christie's Place, to women living with HIV. And I couldn't believe the statistics on the women that were saying that they were not living a promiscuous lifestyle, that they had contracted HIV and AIDS from a monogamous relationship with their partner.
Absolutely.
Brains, live your truth and cover it up. You know, you don't have to be ashamed of who you are. It's a different world now. People are more accepting. Partners, if they truly love you, they are truly accepting what this is doing to your children. How are your daughters, you know, how do they feel about love and relationship and trusting, you know, heterosexual or homosexual relationships now? What do they say?
I brought my girls up to always respect the various types of relationships right from early days when it was taboo to talk about gay relationships and things as well. I was very fortunate to have a very liberated mum and dad growing up and who taught me that all people are equal. So my daughters were also brought up that way. I have two beautiful grandsons. My middle daughter had to help me go through all of my husband's files after his death. And one of the reasons is every now and then he used to look after my grandsons. And we were very fearful that perhaps you've got to be realistic about these things when you find out these things.
He had kept some secrets you didn't know.
Yeah. So we basically had to go through everything together. And that was terribly sad for her, because my girls loved their dad. He was a Jekyll and Hyde. He was a good dad to them.
He was their
hero. Yeah. So, you know, when they found that all out, it was very, very difficult for them. My youngest daughter finds it very difficult to talk about this sort of thing, so we don't talk about that to her. However, my daughter with the little boys she's my best friend. All my girls are my best friends, but she's been a wonderful support system for me through all of this. And we're grateful to find out that my husband liked young androgynous men and older. He wasn't sort of keen on younger little people. Wow. He loved his grandsons. He was very proud of them. Anyway, what happened? Sorry, April.
No, I said I'm glad for the safety of your.
Yeah.
So
it has affected them. It's given them strength. It's given them understanding. What I do appreciate about my girls is they understand loving a person for who the person is. And I've encouraged them over the years to remember the good times and the wonderful things that he did for them and with them. There were many happy times. I'm not saying they were all unhappy.
Right.
What my girls do say is, Mom, he's dead, you're alive, and look at you now. So they're proud of me as well. So.
Well, I'm proud of you too. So we want to springboard forward. We want to talk a little bit about what you're doing right now. We want to talk about your coaching. the Dream Builder Coach, and we want to talk about who is afraid of the big bad wolf.
After he died, I could have gone back to work in the Middle East for a wonderful royal family. They were fabulous to me. In fact, they took me on holiday to the Maldives for 2 weeks.
Wow.
They said, Miss Susan, we must help you recover, the princess I worked for. And she spoiled me and put me in the most wonderful little lodge with overlooking the sea with its own little swimming pool. And I was treated like a princess. Mm-hmm. So I'm very grateful for that. Thank you, princess. And I started to actually reflect there in the Maldives. I don't, if anybody's been to the Maldives, you'll know it's a magical place.
I've heard. I haven't been
there. Very. Oh, you got to go there, April. I'll meet you there. It's beautiful. Anyway, in that time, I was able to really start thinking about my life. And I decided that I didn't want to go back to work in that educational capacity. What I wanted to do was remain with working with people, and I decided I wanted to become a life coach. Mm. Because I've experienced so many things in life, I want to be able to share what I know to be able to uplift people into living the best life they possibly can.
Right.
And I'd already qualified years ago in NLP and cognitive behavioral therapy. It wasn't the type of coaching I really wanted to do. I had this yearning to actually be able to coach people evocatively and actually find what's within them and pull it out and get them to live their truth.
Right.
So I ended up training with Life Mastery Institute. My mentor is Mary Morrissey. We learned with Mary Morrissey and Bob Proctor. And it's working in quantum and metaphysics. And it's a 12-month, it's an incredible program. It's a 12-month study. It's hard work. You have to pass tests and everything throughout the 12 months to be able to reach your goal and to be able to go across to Los Angeles and certify. So her core program is called the Dream Builder Program, and it's what we actually coach people through 99 days, where they start to learn the how to actually find their true selves through our evocative coaching.
Hmm. And so with that coaching, you're going to be able to transform and change some lives and really open people up to what's going on.
This I have.
Incredible.
Already.
And I thank you so much for opening up yourself and your truth and your life experiences with My Brains. We value it so much. And thank you so much for coming all the way from Australia so early in the morning, in the afternoon here. But you got to get on that world clock, okay? You got to know what's going on. So please, Susan Cook, tell My Brains how to get in contact with you if they want to hear more about your incredible stories, if they want to, once you're certified. Now, you're almost certified in the program, right? You're almost certified.
Yes. Oh, I certified 2 years ago.
Oh, wow. Okay. Well, yes. That's great.
I then moved from being a dream builder coach. And I then went on to certify as a life mastery consultant.
Oh, wow.
And that's where we actually teach the most incredible quantum and metaphysics, the programs there. And people, they learn to live. We create a vision blueprint for them. And they actually learn to actually live within that blueprint as if it's really happening. And they actually transform their lives into a life they would truly love to live. They transform their lives. And so some of my clients have had incredible success, and they are living the life of their dreams. Well, I'm living my life of my dreams.
Well, Absolutely. So Tell My Brains, definitely how to get in contact with you, your email, your website, all of that good stuff.
So you can find me on www.susancookcoaching.com. That is my official website where you can actually book a strategy call with me. It's a 40-minute quick call for us to see if we are a good fit. I'm very strict about that. I want to work with people who feel comfortable with me and know that I will turn their life around. I haven't had any rejections yet.
It's hard to reject something like you. I don't know what he was thinking. I have no idea. But I am so glad that you are here on the edge with us. I want to thank you, Brains. Go back. Take your time. Look at the visuals. We got some great stuff. Thank you, baby. We got some great stuff on the edge. We got it on YouTube, Blog Talk, iTunes, Mixcloud, Spotify. We are all over the planet. And we're trying to bring you the best and the brightest so that you can live your truth. It's all right. It's some safe places. There's some wonderful people. Even the people that are with you that you don't think, you don't know what you don't know. So until you have that conversation and you open up your heart to, be it racial differences, cultural differences, lifestyle differences, sexual orientation, you just don't know. You're missing out on so much. So thank you so much, Susan, for being here on the edge with us. Come back and tell us, girl, I could talk to you for a week. You got some great stuff, and we're going to hook up real soon, okay?
Thank you so much, April. I've had such fun talking to you. And I just want everybody to know that life is good. And you couldn't know better than to live your life in the now, because tomorrow you mightn't wake up. Mm-hmm. So it's very important to be your to live your truth.
That's right. Preach, sister. All right. I love you guys, and I'll talk to you soon. Thank you, Susan.
Love you, April. Heart. And that's aroha. Aroha means I love you in Maori.
All right. Better get your education on, Brains. Talk to you soon.
Bye, April. Bye.